Hello, I'm Britannia, consciousness coach, trainer, and explorer of what it means to be human. Welcome to Inspiring Global Transformation. I will be interviewing pioneers, thought leaders, and leaders of companies from all over the world. People who walk to a different beat, have chosen a different path, and in doing so are leading the way for global transformation. My hope is that these ideas will inspire, encourage, and support you to get involved or to start something of your very own. Hello. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Chris May. He's one of four directors of Maiden, an insightful healthcare technology company based in Bath. The reason I'm chatting to Chris is that he is reported to be the one who had the inspiration to convert Maiden from a normal hierarchical company into one that is a predominantly flat-structured company.
Ever since I became aware of Maiden, I've just been fascinated by the fact that you've got a sort of virtually flat structure and just really interested to find out, you know, from you, because it was, I understand it was your idea, is that right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, according to everyone else, it was your idea.
but for similar reasons to you, it's how to get the best out of people.
And where did you come up with the idea? That's something that I've often puzzled over.
I think that, the trouble is, you can rationalise this going back in history, but the truth is it's lots of different strands that happened at different times. And when people want the kind of, when they've got time for the full history, my first experience of trying to get the best out of people was when I worked at Cadbury's on the chocolate production line. And I was made production manager of cream eggs. And this was a really poorly performing shift. So there were four shifts. And they made me production manager in order to try and improve the efficiency of this particular shift. And the way I went about it was, I guess the first thing I noticed when I went onto the planet was that everybody's jobs were really boring and monotonous and tedious. And you could see that in the people. And so I decided to mix it up a bit and actually let people try a variety of jobs, and you know, so get people who are normally wrapping the products into packaging, or people making chocolate. You know, there was lots of roles, about 50 people on the production line altogether. So I kind of instituted the system where they would all move around and try different things. To cut a long story short, it was a complete disaster.
For this amazing sort of revelation of how wonderful it had been.
It was awful. I couldn't believe what happened. I just thought I was making their lives more interesting, and but actually they just weren't of that mindset at all. They needed to know where their position was. They needed, you know, they actually had ownership of their particular wrapping machine. And you know, when I mean, you know, if I were to give you this interview and it's full version, there would be a lot of foul language I would need to use at this point, because what they said to each other and the way they attacked each other because one person just ruined the set up the wrapping machine wrong, or not the way that the previous person had done it, and you know, and it was just it was just chaos ensued. So I had to kind of retreat from that, but it did get me to ask kind of questions about why that didn't work in that scenario. Whereas if I'd been a worker on that production line, I would have been bored out of my mind and desperate to try different things.
I'm not the kind of person that can do the same thing over and over again every day either.
But that's going back a long time. But I've always been interested in the whole thing about getting the most out of people. And then, you know, it was clear at Maiden that we weren't getting most out of people. We weren't being productive. We weren't getting stuff out of the door. This is going back about 6 years. It was some things just weren't happening, and you could sense it in the morale and the atmosphere and the vibe within the office. It just wasn't working, and so started to struggle with what to do about that. And that's when the journey really started. I had a number of stages to it.
Yeah, and the idea, I mean, did you read Frederic Laloux's work, or where did the idea of the...
The first book I read on it was a book called Holacracy.
Okay, I write that down.
Yeah, it's and actually, it was the opening chapter which really pricked my interest, because what it does is it referred to some studies where basically what it says is, as communities get bigger, villages, towns, cities, the productivity per population actually increases. Whereas organizations get bigger, sort of from small business to medium-sized business to large business, the productivity actually gets worse. So that left me with a question saying, well, how can you organize a company like a town or a village? Yeah. And, to kind of get the most of that. And then you start to explore, well, why are things different in a village than they are in a company? And you start to kind of realize that, there are differences. There are still rules you have to obey. There are still structures that you have to operate within. But you just have a lot more autonomy and freedom, in your home life to live your life and to make the most of it. And so I started to really explore that kind of idea with respect to, the company.
That's interesting. And especially, sorry, just as you're sort of sharing this, it sort of makes me think of how, because I live in a little village, how the community has changed as well during the whole COVID crisis, and how in a business, I wouldn't necessarily see or expect to see the same care and sort of support and connecting to each other that you would see necessarily in a village.
Well, and that's interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know your village, of course, but nobody would have necessarily been the boss of that.
Exactly.
You're not in a hierarchy. Somebody would have taken a lead, maybe, or taken an initiative, and that might have been followed by someone responding to it or taking another initiative. But it's lots of people acting, autonomously that kind of get you whatever the end result is. And I think the other thing is that you've got the collective, we hire people with brains. We look for talented people. So you have a lot of collective brain power within a company, as you might do in your village. Yeah. And allowing those brains to roam freely, I think, gets you a lot more than having a kind of a rigid hierarchy where actually the brains that are at the bottom of the hierarchy are effectively oppressed.
Yeah.
Their voice doesn't get heard. And we recruit some very talented people straight out of university, and it's clear, from day one that they're talented. But say putting them at the bottom of a hierarchy and saying, right, your journey starts now.
You have to go through these steps.
Yeah, you've got to go through the steps and all the rest of it. It basically stifles them from day one, and that's just got to be wrong. You're not getting the most out of them. So, wanted to avoid that too.
Yeah, and then, so when you hire people, what are the sort of things you look for? Obviously, you said brains, but one of the things that I wanted to ask about is, to me, a flat structure might not be for everybody. I don't know that because I haven't worked in an organisation that has a flat structure, but what is your experience of that?
So it's certainly not for everybody. I think the received wisdom is that when you start this process, typical organisations who have done it, mainly in America, have lost about 20% of their staff.
Wow.
We've certainly had people who didn't fit in. They needed to be managed, basically. I mean, you asked a number of questions there,
Sorry, I got a bit excited.
and it's quite interesting. So let's... what was the first question you asked me?
I kind of sort of asked the first question, which really I suppose should be the last question. So I suppose the first sort of questions would be, in sort of making this change, are there sort of personality traits or things about people that you've noticed would fit better with a flat structure?
Oh, that's right. You asked me the recruitment question. That was a bit, I forgot.
Yeah, the recruitment question leads on to that.
So yes, there definitely is. So let's do it from the recruitment angle. So, we used to recruit on skills and experience, which is, what a lot of people do. You get their CVs, you look at the experience, you shortlist, and you look at their skills, and generally you put people into posts. That proved to us to not be the right way to recruit, because you didn't necessarily get people with the right attitude and the right approach. So we actually, and this is going back quite a long time, we switched to recruiting on the basis of aptitude and attitude. And so we didn't actually ask for people to have the experience or the skills. We could teach them that. What we wanted was people to have the right mindset coming in. And then that went through an evolution again when we still made some mistakes in recruitment. And we actually hired a psychologist to help us with a recruitment process. And what she did was she tipped the entire recruitment process on its head and basically said, instead of trying to find the people that you want, hire on the basis of weeding out the people you don't want. So now our interview process has a large component of it, which is designed to spot the people that wouldn't fit into the organisation, and make sure that we don't take them on.
Because I mean, I've been in a position to hire people in the past as well, and on paper, people can look amazing, and then when they get there, the fit is just so completely wrong.
Yeah. And of course, the first thing we get is a CV, and so you do use that basis. But we now have a structured process of trying to, you know, make sure that one, we do find the right people. So there's an element to that, but moreover, it's about not making mistakes and not getting the wrong people.
Yeah, and then something, sorry, as you've been talking, that came to me as well is, I mean, like many companies in the UK, you've sort of more home based now than you were before we went into lockdown. But I know for quite a long time you have had employees that worked remotely as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
And how have you found that? Because I know that it was something that people were very concerned about in some organisations, that if people work from home, they wouldn't get the same level of productivity as they would if they'd been in the office.
So I think the opposite is true. I think generally you get more productivity when people are working at home because they don't have the distractions. Well, actually, they could have home distractions. So the home environment has to be conducive to working. But assuming that problem has been solved, generally, they can be extremely productive. What you don't necessarily, where you lose is sometimes the communication is lacking from the home workers into the company, but also from the company to the home workers. And also, you don't necessarily get the full power of their brains and things like creative thinking, etc. Because when you have meetings in the office, where you're trying to find a solution to a problem, it can be quite difficult to engage the people at home as much as, you know, the people that are in the room. And we find that a mixture of half a team being in the office and half a team being at home is probably the worst of all possible worlds. So we'd rather have everyone at home or everybody in the office, and we've worked that out through trial and error.
And so what happens then when you have half and half? What do you think goes wrong?
I think what happens is it's the people at home kind of get excluded. I think that within the room there is there's that physical presence, and there's the body language and all of the things that you pick up that we're not aware of a lot of the time. And so what happens is you kind of get this rapport going on within a room that's not necessarily shared by the people online. Once you've got everyone at home, everybody's back on the level playing field, and they're all on hangouts like this. But I think we lose something. And what's really interesting is that since lockdown started, there have been lots and lots of articles about how home working has been brilliant and how it's really worked, and people didn't think it would, and everyone's finding that it does. What we've not seen so much of is what are we missing by having people not in the office anymore? And I'm really interested in that because I absolutely believe we're missing something, and it's quite important. But it is about creativity and innovation. I think that takes a step back in this kind of working environment.
And I think also a level of care. When you're sort of with people all the time, you can see how they are. And I know from working in an office in the past myself, you build relationships and you care about those people and how they're doing and what they're doing. And there's sort of little interactions like that that you wouldn't get if you were.
Yeah, I think, I don't think that applies to us. We work in mental health, as you know. And so mental health in the workplace has been a big thing for us for quite a few years. And you know, you can't work in mental health and then be very bad at it. So we've been pains to make sure that actually as a company, we're very good. And actually one of the aspects of that, which I discovered quite latterly and quite stupidly, because I was a bit short-sighted, working in mental health, we were actually starting to take on people who actually did suffer from mental health conditions. And I didn't know that. I didn't kind of spot it. And when we started to be quite open and transparent about, you know, our mental well-being, you know, people would start being open and honest about their own struggles. And what I realized was that we had recruited quite a few people who had struggles of one form or another. And then it got to the point where people were actually admitting that they had mental health struggles, even at interview, when they were applying, because they saw Maiden as a safe place for somebody with mental health issues, because we worked in mental health. And what was really good was that this didn't come out because they were having struggles at work. Actually, you couldn't even see it. You know, we'd seem to have created an environment that they felt was safe. And so there was no outward kind of signs that people were struggling. It was only when we started sharing more that people became, you know, more open about it. So anyway, going into lockdown, we've taken that entire culture of caring with us. And because of the way we work, which is in self-managing teams, the teams are very, have a kind of a very pastoral side to their nature. And if one team member is struggling, it gets picked up very quickly by the rest of the team. So, and they all look out for each other. And we have a massive support infrastructure for anybody that's struggling. There's all sorts of things that we've got in place. In fact, yesterday I saw a slide which summarised all of the things that we put in place to help people who are struggling. And there was something like, you know, about a dozen things on it that, you know, people can go to. One of the things we've done, and probably one of the most important, is we took out all the managers. So that was probably the biggest single shift that we made when we moved out of hierarchy into flat structure. We just literally overnight pretty much took out everybody that had job title manager and replaced them with coaches. So we now have a coaching model where anybody in the organization can have a coach. They can elect their own coach, so they're, you know, their coach isn't assigned to, then they can choose from us. So I think we trained about 20 people to be coaches. And now, you know, everybody has a coach that they've chosen themselves that they can go to if they really want to talk about something in a confidential, safe space.
So. I think that's amazing. I mean, I'm a coach, so I'm a little bit biased. But I do think that, I mean, the space of a coaching, you know, having somebody on your side that isn't trying to sort of convince you of this and that and whatever, yeah, and having a safe space to explore something is just invaluable.
No, absolutely. I mean, I have a coach. So one of the, you know, the people in Maiden is my coach. And when I've got a knotty problem that I need to work through, then, you know, I will call her for a coaching session and we will sort of work through it. And it is really, really useful just to air your thoughts out loud, but also get challenged, you know.
Yeah. And also too, because sometimes we can kind of get set on a way of seeing something or thinking about something. And just having somebody ask questions that opens you up and gets you to step back makes you see so many more possibilities that you might not have otherwise seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes they help you see yourself.
Hopefully, that would be quite good. Sometimes it's not what we really want to be seeing. Is
absolutely. I get things pointed out to me where something I've done or said is, you know, has been taken from a different perspective than the way that it was meant. And you need to understand these things and not keep them quiet. So, you know, we've tried to keep a very open, transparent organisation where there is free-flowing information of that nature, particularly about understanding each other and communicating. And we've done lots of personality type profiling things that that help build teams and help understand how each other likes to communicate and how each other likes to be communicated to. And all of that's really helped in just kind of building the team strength, really.
I think one of the biggest challenges that we have as humans is understanding. Because I think when you understand somebody else, then all the animosity, well, not all of it, but most of it dissipates.
Yes, it does.
you know, it's that's what we sort of so lack most of the time, is being understood and an understanding. Mm. Because we're so busy trying to, I suppose, get across who we want people to see us as, or covering up things that we think we're deficient in and whatever else. I think that's incredible. Yeah. And just to go back to when you sort of changed the whole structure with the managers and things, what were the challenges you faced? I mean, that must have been pretty tough for some of the people.
Yeah, it was. I think certainly there were people, well, there were lots of challenges. So don't get me wrong, this is not easy. It's been a work in progress over a few years, and we've had a number of challenges along the way. In terms of the managers, yes, there was certainly a feeling amongst some of them that they'd lost status. And we had to overcome that. Interesting that some of those managers now, for whom the status was quite important, are now the biggest advocates of our coaching program. And actually write about it, you know. So there's been a number of blogs, you know, published on that.
What was the sort of learning that came out of that with the transition? What would you say were the best practices in managing that?
Of managing.
Transition to sort of changing that sort of status that people saw that they had.
I think it was. I think one of the tenets of having a flat structure is you can't impose things on people. And you know, we're now at a place where actually we try and succeed mainly in not imposing any sort of change on people at all. So you have to start out as you mean to go on. So it wasn't as if we said to people, you're no longer a manager, and took their status away. There was, it was a series of conversations really that, you know, this is the organization we want to create. This is, you know, how we want things to be going forward. So it was kind of more a gradual persuasion and, you know, and trying to convince people to give this a go and see, you know, how it worked. And people were skeptical. And, you know, that it would work, or that they would be happy in the new world. And some weren't, you know. So, you know, some people did leave the organisation. But actually, in retrospect, I don't think any of the ones that left initially were people that would have been happy in the new structure. You know,
yeah. And what percentage of people would you say you lost then?
I think overall, it was over a couple of years, but probably about 20%. You know, and actually some of them were people that just needed to be managed. You know, they were actually very productive if they had a manager, and but you took their manager away and they just were completely unable to prioritize or manage their own work, which is interesting. But if you think about it, if you're paying someone, let's just say, you know, a salary of £25,000, and you employ and this is a real life example. And then I was employing somebody else who was spending a day a week managing that person, the equivalent of a day a week managing that person. That managing that person was costing me, you know, another £10,000 effectively. So for that person, the first person to be productive, they were really costing me £35,000, even though their salary was £25,000. So there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of waste in that kind of structure you can quantify, because if that person was able to manage themselves and prioritize their own work, then actually there's a saving there straight away. And you could do the maths and work out that a lot of money was going in managing people that actually shouldn't really need to be managed, if only they were able to, you know, manage their own.
Manage themselves. Yeah. And I suppose in the society that we're brought up in, we're not really encouraged to manage ourselves. So through education and stuff, we're sort of told.
Oh, tell me about it. Okay, so you were asking about, so you're asking about challenges. You can go back to education, or you can go back to, you know, the evolution of human beings. So what you have to realise is that you're fighting against millions of years of evolution here. So you opened this talk, you know, when we were talking at the beginning about being really interested in human psychology and how it ticks, etc. And the honest truth is that, you know, we share descendants from, you know, the chimp world, and chimps form hierarchies. They naturally do that, you know. And human beings, it's no surprise, therefore, that we naturally form hierarchies. That's kind of our almost how we've been programmed. And that can't be bad, because the fact is we've survived as a species by forming hierarchical societies, as we've done. I read a really interesting book a few years ago. It's probably one of the best books I've read this decade, actually, but talks about how actually humanity was now probably 90% chimp and 10% bee. There is an element to us, in psychological terms, which has a bit of a hive mind and is, you know, more caring of the hive and the community that we serve than we may have been, you know, historically. And that's what we're trying to tap into. And it's the book's called The Righteous Mind.
Okay, because I'm going to put show notes below anyway. So anything that you mention, the books, I'll just, so that anyone's listening, I'll put a link to those books below.
It's called The Righteous Mind, and it's actually a book about where we get our morals and ethics from.
Because that's something that, anyway, no, I don't know if we're going to go into that topic. Sorry, I was just realising where that was taking me. It was into one of the no-nos of politics, religion and all that kind of thing.
Well, the subtitle of that book is Why Good People Differ on Politics and Religion. That's what the subtitle is. And so it has a whole section on politics and why people have different political views. It has a whole section on religion. And, you know, and it basically kind of says, look, you've got two people here. They differ wildly on their politics. They differ wildly on their religious views. But, they are still good people. You know, it's not that one's bad and one's good. And it basically explores through kind of the whole looking at moral psychology, how that comes about. But the initial part of the book is just it's just full of lots and lots of studies that, just prove how our minds work and how we interact with each other. But this kind of sense that as we're evolving and our societies are evolving, that we're actually starting to develop a hive mind rather than a chimp mind, means that we're actually starting to open up more to the possibility of organising our societies in different ways, and therefore we can organise our companies in different ways. Now we come back to the point you were making. So we created an educational structure where you do your GCSEs, then you get onto the next rung of the ladder, you do your A-levels, you get onto the next rung of the ladder, you do your degree and maybe your postgraduate degree. And so when you take people from the education system into a company, they're already used to climbing a ladder and climbing a hierarchy. So their mind is already in that sort of frame of mind. So you suddenly pitch them into a company and you say, well, we'll take the ladder's not here. And they're saying, well, where's the next rung? You know, where's the ladder? Yeah. And you can say there isn't one. And they really struggle with it. So the biggest shock that I had when we started doing this was I thought that creating a flat structure, self-managing teams, you know, would appeal to the millennials. You know, all of the texts and the received wisdom says this is the generation that is ready for this. And I thought all the middle-aged people like me, you know, who have had lots of careers, would really, really struggle with this idea. What was really interesting is that the opposite was true. And the people who had lots of experiences in other companies found the whole thing really refreshing, and they gained a new freedom that they'd never known before in any organisation. Suddenly all the politics had gone, you know, people were sharing information. It was much more pastoral.
There's no trying to get above somebody or put somebody down because you're always...
Yeah, you're no longer trying to, you know, fight within a hierarchy to get onto the next ladder, because you're always competing with someone else to do that. And the millennials, and the graduates particularly, really struggled with it because that's not where their mindset were at. And it was made even worse by the fact that at weekends they would go home or meet up with their friends who had all graduated with them, and they'd all joined hierarchical companies. And so while they the staff at Maiden were not necessarily progressing in the normal sense that we understand it, their peers were progressing in leaps and bounds, you know, and lots of them within a couple of years were the, you know, senior vice president of FAL, and, you know, so but that really, they really felt that quite keenly. And I thought that was going to be our biggest problem, because I didn't know what to do about convincing them that this was you know, things were better at Maiden.
It's about valuing themselves, isn't it? Yeah. It's something to do with,
yeah. It is about valuing themselves, and people clearly valued themselves via their job titles and things. What actually happened was that I didn't know how to solve this problem. I didn't know what to do about it. But it kind of solved itself, because what happened was that our staff would go to conferences and, you know, where they would meet up with other people who were like themselves in other companies that had a hierarchical structure, and they would exchange their experiences of working at Maiden versus working at these others organisations. And what they gradually discovered over time, that these people had really fancy job titles, but they had no autonomy. They, you know, they were in a quite a rigid command and control structure, and they had no freedom, no responsibility, and they weren't able to, you know, to act independently at all. And despite the fact that their job titles seemed to give the impression that they did, whereas actually at Maiden they were able to make decisions and, you know, spend money and without necessarily asking permission. And they suddenly realised that, you know, these job titles were a bit, you know, kind of smoke and mirrors, really. They didn't really mean that much.
Yeah. It's actually interesting. My kids, before we came back to the UK, they used to go to an international school. And one of the things I really loved about it is they would do a topic, say, for instance, explorers. And instead of just being given what the teacher gave them on explorers, they were asked to choose an explorer that they found interesting and then go away and research it.
Right.
And then share, then all of them would come back and do a presentation and share to the class what they'd learned. So not only did they learn about their specific area, but they then learnt about everybody else's research. And just having that freedom to choose what you were interested in was just so much more enlivening, because it meant when they studied it, it was something they were passionate about and they were interested in.
Yeah.
And it was just a different way of doing things, which I suppose is kind of, it's funny how you said sort of incrementally everything sort of builds. And I suppose that's part of the reason why I'm interested in doing things differently, because I see the value in, yeah, other experiences than what we sort of generally do.
Yeah. And, you know, we've obviously tried to create that. I think, you know, we talk to lots of companies that are trying to do something similar to us, but at the moment we seem to be more advanced than most, and there's a number of universities which have been studying us which seem to recognize that too. But I think the key to that is not that we've got a flat structure and self-managing teams, because other organizations have gone some way down that route. Is we've combined it with agile working. So we know lots of companies who are trying agile working, but within a hierarchy. And we know quite a few companies who are, you know, doing flat structure type organizational change, but they don't have agile working. And I think it's a combination of those two things that's really unlocked, you know, what is now the Maiden culture.
And what do you think the agile working brings then, that, say, doing it without the agile working, what is it that unlocks?
Well, the first problem we had to solve, so this going back to 2014, when I said there was kind of, it was chaos really, and we weren't being very productive, is software developers, particularly, you know, because that was they've always represented about half the company. They like to focus on something, and they don't like to be interrupted. You know, they like to get a job done, and they like to deliver a piece of software before they move on to the next thing. And what was actually happening, you know, 6 years ago was that they were constantly being interrupted. You know, new priorities would come in; they were told to drop everything and do something else, and it just wasn't working. And so they wanted to, you know, to kind of change their way of working to sort of prevent this, what they saw as being chaotic. And, you know, it's actually one of our software developers who went on a course and on Scrum, which is a form of agile working, and said, you know, can we just explore this and see, give it a try? And so we got the trainer in, we had a very short meeting with him. He convinced us within half an hour that we should give this a go. We within a week we trained everybody, and we completely, and this we did do in, you know, 7 days, we moved everybody onto an agile way of working within that time frame. Now what that does is they work in sprints, generally 2 weeks long, and you plan a sprint. And the idea of sprint planning is that you have this list of tasks, they're all prioritized, and you agree which ones that you're going to do over the next 2 weeks in that sprint. And it's a process of negotiation. People are not told what they've got to do. They're basically saying, well, this is a priority. What can you take off the priority list and what can you deliver in 2 weeks? And a team will say, well, I think I can do tasks 1, 2, 5, and 7 or something, and we can deliver those over the next 2 weeks. And they commit to doing that. And then you basically just leave them for 2 weeks. And then you have a sprint review at the end of the 2 weeks where they have to demonstrate that that's what they've delivered, you know, tasks 1, 2, 3, and 5 and yeah. 7 or whatever. So now what that means is that you don't need to manage them. During that 2 week period, you can leave them alone and go and do something else. So in some ways, we'd taken out a lot of the management even before we decided to change our organizational structure. And I remember one day walking into the office and it was empty. And I said, you know, where is everybody? And apparently a trampoline park had opened in Bath and they'd all gone trampolining, you know. And I kind of I stood there for a moment thinking, you know, because what happens is there's the thing called the mill owner kicks in, you know, when you're a business owner, there's this tendency to act like a mill owner and thinking, you know, all the workers have abandoned their posts or whatever. And this thing kicks in and it's a, you know, it's a primeval thing. And anyway, and then I had to stop myself and just think, no, actually, that's fine. They have to deliver their sprint, you know, in 2 weeks' time. And do I care how they do it or when they do it or not? So they had a couple of hours out in Bath trampolining, but then they came back and then they worked in the office late, you know, to make up the hours that day. And they had the freedom and the autonomy to do that. And of course, at the end of the 2 weeks, they delivered their sprint, everything was done. And I realized, actually, as long as they deliver what they've committed to deliver, I don't care how they do it or when they do it or where they do it, to be honest. And that way of working has been the primary reason why when we went into lockdown, it all worked seamlessly. Because
that was one of the things that I noticed was, I've spoken to some of the people at Maven. And it seemed like they didn't miss a step almost in the transition. Yeah.
They went home at 5 o'clock one Monday night and 9 o'clock Tuesday morning. Everybody was online on Hangouts, just carrying on as if nothing had happened. They were all in the middle of a sprint, so you know, we didn't have to do any regroup or anything. There was no managers who suddenly had to dive in and make sure everyone was organised. It just all happened. And you're right, they didn't skip a beat. Which was, you know, a kind of a testament to the way of working. And as you said, we already had remote workers and people were used to working at home and being on Hangouts anyway. So there was nothing really new to, you know, to the lockdown situation that we were in those early days, and at least. So.
And then just really, because I know that sort of time is ticking on and there's a few things that I'm very keen to find out about. Okay. So we spoke about in the beginning with sort of getting the idea and how you explored it. But how did you approach sort of bringing that idea to the company? And what was the resistance that you met and how did you overcome it? Again, I know there's a lot of questions.
Okay. So there was a very pivotal moment, which was in November 2016. I remember it well. We had for some years conducted annual staff surveys, and we asked the same 26 questions of the staff on an annual basis, and we use it as a means of just taking the temperature of how happy the staff are. And the questions start with questions about strategy, and they kind of end with, I think the final question is, you know, are you proud to work at Maiden? And there's all sorts of things in between on training and development and progression, etc. And in November 2016, we had quite a significant drop in our scores. So we got the staff survey results back and they dipped quite significantly. And that was a real wake-up call. And the way that we would normally announce the staff survey results is at staff day. So we would do the staff survey just before the staff day. And I realized, seeing the results, that you know, that we had to respond to this. And so we organized the entire staff survey about how do we respond to this negative survey result. You know, and because we actually had, you know, all the areas within these 26 questions where we were scoring low, then we actually used our staff day to break the whole company into teams and effectively create a whole to-do list, a backlog of work, we call it in agile terms, of what we needed to address in order to get those scores back up, you know, and make people happier about things. So we effectively created, in one afternoon, a huge organizational change program of all of the things that we needed to do. And it was not that we created it, the staff created it themselves. And then, having got this huge backlog of, you know, our to-do list that we needed to work on, we then set about, you know, deliberately and, you know, addressing each point in turn. And we didn't, you know, some things were easier to address than others. You know, some things like, you know, career progression, it's taken longer to kind of get to that point because for the reasons we were talking about earlier. But things like decision-making protocols, I think we had in place within a few months, you know. First thing we did was work on our values and make sure we all agreed and understood what our values were. But again, they weren't imposed. The staff, you know, the teams came up with the values and we... you know, we effectively had something which was co-created by everybody. And in fact, this entire way of working has been co-created by the company as a whole. But that's when it started.
Okay. That's quite interesting. And then in regards to sort of career progression and I suppose salaries and things like that and leave, how do people in a flat structure make those decisions as to their sort of the pay that they get and all that kind of thing?
So that's an interesting one. There have been organisations where staff have chosen their own salaries.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
And there aren't that many of them, but they do exist. And we kind of thought inevitably we would go down, that's where we would end up. You know, it wasn't something we would do initially because, you know, we had a few more things to work on. And we thought that would really put the cat amongst the pigeons. But... We are at a point where if all of the salaries were exposed, I like to think that everybody would recognise that they were being paid fairly, you know, considering the contribution that they're making, you know, compared to their peers and everything else. And so we're in a position where I was always, you know, for the last few years, have been ready for that to happen. But one of the things we do annually is we do a review of our reward strategy. We ask the staff how they want to be rewarded and how things like salaries, bonuses, annual leave, and you know, we have quite a generous reward package. And that has been selected effectively by the staff. But one of the things that they've been quite clear about is they don't want to choose their own salaries. Or to have the salaries exposed, they still want that to be the role of the directors. But the directors still do it by taking soundings from the staff. So we effectively act as a, you know...
I suppose it's easier for people to generalise on what they think should be paid rather than say, I would think I should be paid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they do. And actually, the other thing that's been really interesting is that we have performance bonus going back, you know, a long, long time. Something I wish I'd never done, because it is divisive. And if anything, having a good performance bonuses doesn't really incentivize people, but it really does disincentivize people when you take it away. And if you have a bad year in the company and the bonus pot isn't as big, and suddenly people don't get paid bonuses, that actually can upset people. And the disbenefit is far greater than the benefit. You know, so anybody listening to this podcast, my advice is, don't institute a performance bonus. And actually what's happened in this annual survey of rewards, we have gradually moved from individual performance bonus to team performance bonus. And actually even more than that to what is effectively a profit share. So a company performance bonus. Yes. More and more of the staff are basically telling us, actually, I don't want to be paid for my own individual performance. I want it to be, you know, just based on the performance of the company as a whole and to have my fair share of that because we're all in it together kind of thing, which is great, you know.
And actually, funnily enough, saying that brings me back to sort of thinking about when we started the conversation, I spoke about sort of being in a village and how people take responsibility. And I know most people that live in a village or live in a city or a town, whatever, it's theirs, it belongs to them. So they care about how it looks and how it's cared for and what happens in it. And I suppose that goes the same if you're getting a share of the profits of a company. It's more yours.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you're interviewing me, and the staff have very kindly labelled me as the architect of all of this, but it's really not true. I mean, maybe I initiated it and had the idea and pushed it forward, but in fact, for the last few years, the culture has been, it can be completely evolved by the staff themselves. You know, not by me. I've just been a voice in the room.
And that sort of, I suppose, brings me, because you've got three directors, is that right?
Yeah, me and three directors, so four altogether, yeah.
And
two men, two women. Just we have a board, yeah, that's gender balanced. Yeah, so.
And in regards to that, what is your reasoning for keeping those four? How do you see their roles within the company? Do you think you would ever allow the company just to be completely flat, or do you think that that's pivotal that those four roles stay?
So it's a really good question. It's something we challenge ourselves all the time. And I think the directors' roles will stay. So internally, the directors' roles sit in the flat structure. And they, we do determine strategy, and we determine the kind of the governance and the framework in which everyone operates. But actually, you know, we then get out of the way and we just let the things go on. We do retain line management responsibility. So when there is an issue which can't be dealt with through coaching or through the teams themselves, etc., then things do get elevated to the directors, and the traditional line manager kind of role then has to kick in, you know, particularly with, you know, if there's an issue of poor performance or poor behavior. Happens very rarely. We don't have that many problems, but occasionally there's something you have to deal with. So it's kind of there as a safety net. But I think the biggest reason for having directors, and the reason why I don't think we will ever lose them, is because the outside world does not recognize a company with a flat structure. So when you look at all of our HR legal frameworks, when you look at all of the regulatory stuff that we have to abide by as a company, it all assumes that you are operating with a hierarchy. So, for example, we've got ISO 27001, which is the Information Security International Standard, which is kind of really important to us. And when you look at those standards and what you have, it basically says you have to have people with these titles, and there are titles with manager in and title, you know, and there is a hierarchy that they expect to see. And so when they come in to visit us and they say, well, you know, who's playing this role and who's playing that role and, you know, et cetera. And you kind of say, look, you have to understand this is a flat structure. We have self-managing teams. We have the roles, but we do not do it in the way that your documentation suggests we should be doing it. And that is repeated throughout the entire regulatory framework in which, you know, companies operate these days. And one of the things that, you know, the outside world expects to see is a functioning board with directors, you know, who are responsible ultimately for, you know, what goes on in the business. So, the law effectively doesn't allow you to do this. Yeah. So I think, unfortunately, I think we're stuck with directors, you know, love them.
It's fascinating, really, because I would never have guess that the law wouldn't have allowed you, but now that you say it sounds so completely obvious. And then I suppose, sort of as we come towards the end of our time together, I just really would like to clarify for anyone listening, what do you think have been the biggest challenges, A, to starting this process, and B, that you see now, sort of with where you are moving forwards?
Okay.
Next steps, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in summary, I think the biggest challenges are ultimately, the human mindset, that we are programmed for hierarchy. We're programmed by evolution, we're programmed by the education system, and so you are working against, you know, a lot of history.
And what do you do about that? So how do you approach it that allows you to move past that?
I think one of the things you can do is just be completely open about it. and say, look, you know, we are all programmed. You know, you might think you have an independent brain that, you know, and you're your own person. But actually, I think teaching people that we have a lot of, including ourselves, and that's really important, that actually we have a lot of cognitive biases, you know, all sorts of descriptions is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, from where I sort of sit, I mean, as I said in the beginning, my sort of passion is about conscious awareness. And when I look at the behaviours that just most of us involve ourselves in every single day, at least 95% of what we do and think and behave in is all subconscious programming.
Yeah.
And it's quite overwhelming when you think that actually you aren't really being you the majority of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned the righteous mind before. I mean, the only chapters of that really challenge you on a whole series of ethical and moral dilemmas about, you know, how we really think, and so it's fascinating, and I love being challenged about things like that. So it really makes me think about it. So you've got all of that, and then of course you've got society as a whole, and how even when you try and create this bubble, there is a pressure of the external world telling you that, well, we're not, no one else is doing it this way. You know, you're kind of going against the flow, really. And but you know, there are now lots of tools and books and things and videos you can watch, which, you know, are helpfully convince people that actually you know, this is worth trying. And then the biggest challenge, of course, is ego. And and that's not the ego of the team. It's actually the ego of the managers and the ego of ultimately the bosses and the directors. You know, if they're used to being in control and commanding people, and they like that, you know, then, you know, it's quite a threat to them to move away from.
They're giving up part of who they see themselves as.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, it's a power thing. So, you know, you have to leave your ego at the door. And you have to get your affirmation, therefore, in other ways.
Yeah.
And that can be quite difficult. I guess I'm just not naturally a bossy boss. I don't enjoy bossing people around. I do enjoy watching people thrive and then seeing the impact that has on the organization as a whole. But I don't think that's normal. I think, you know, a lot of people who rise to the top of hierarchies do so because they bullied their way there, frankly. And I see this all the time. And therefore, they're just not of the mindset to give that up. So
it's interesting. I mean, I've worked in many organizations and I find it very interesting that a lot of people who get promoted don't actually get promoted necessarily on their abilities to really truly lead, as I would see, a good leadership. It's based on results and I suppose showing the coming across in the way that people will accept, if that makes sense, more than actually on who they're being.
Yeah, I mean, people have all sorts of, you know, reasons why they get promoted, I guess. And some just want it more, they're more hungry for it. And they do all of the things that they think they need to do, you know. But their focus then is on their own promotion and their own... it's not on the company, it's not on the rest of the team. And you have to start stepping on people. People withhold information so they don't share, so the information is power. You kind of get a lot more internal politics. I mean, I would say we have very little internal politics at Maiden, you know, but that's not, you know, my experience of being in hierarchical organizations before. There is a lot.
And then just to round up, where to now for Maiden? I mean, obviously it's a co-creative organism now. But if you were to kind of look into the future, what do you feel the next sort of iterations are going to be?
This is definitely a journey. So I think we've gone down this path to a greater extent than lots of organisations, but we certainly don't see that we're at the end of it at all. So we've got a number of things to work on. And also, I think sometimes, like everything else, you work on something, you think you've got it sussed, And you put that on, you put that to one side and work on something else. And then, you know, a year down the line, you've realized actually you've let that slip. So you're constantly kind of revisiting. And of course, you've got people coming into the organization all the time. And we've been growing fast. We're taking on lots of new recruits, and they need embedding. But actually, one of the things you realize is that everybody who joins an organization, especially this kind of organization, changes it in some way. You know? Yeah. And if you take on another sort of 15, 20 people a year that, you know, as we've been doing, they can have quite a big impact on the culture. So the culture kind of pulls them in and pushes against them, and they influence the culture. So the whole thing is constantly sort of in flux and is self-correcting and, you know, and self, you know, kind of regulating in a way. So it's never going to be a fixed thing. It's always going to be sort of, you know, moving, just like a village.
Yeah, and just like us as individuals. I mean, I hope that I never stop learning and growing, because to me, it's very incredible.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. So I could tell you what today's challenges are, but I in a few months' time, you know, the challenges will be something different. So yeah, I think what we do is what we have done is we've got a framework now of all the different elements that make up this culture. And we just go around them all, addressing them each in turn and saying, you know, where are we with this? Where are we with that? And we will always, you know, just focus on the things where we think we may have slipped and, or, you know, things have gone awry slightly, or where we need to do a bit more progressive work or a bit more development. So, yeah, it will never stop.
Well, thank you ever so much. And thank you for your time. And it's been really fabulous speaking with you.
I am Britannia, and you've been listening to the Inspiring Global Transformation. If you've enjoyed this, make sure you subscribe, and if you have a moment, we would love to hear from you, so please leave us a review. If you want more from me, I have blogs, videos, meditations, courses, social media links, and more on my website, www.britannia.com. That is BRITTANYA.com. Thank you so much for listening, and lots of love from me to you.